The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Later in the program, Ron Gula on the Gula Tech Foundation's goals and its first batch of awardees. But first, joining us are retired United States Navy Commander Chris Hoffman, former Deputy Director of the Naval Academy Cyber Program, working for none other than Chris Inglis. He spent 10 years as a cyber intel officer, and he's now with the cybersecurity firm Red Jack. And our friend Justin Sherman of the Atlantic Council Think Tank, who is also a contributor to Wired Magazine. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Gentlemen, three of our favorite words are cyber, China, and Russia. Chris, I want to start off with you. Obviously, you know, folks were grappling with SolarWinds. Justin's joined us a couple of times to discuss that, as is Admiral Rogers, as well as Chris Inglis, as well as Suzanne Spaulding and many others. But then the Chinese launched the whole Hafnium attack, right? I mean, using Microsoft's vulnerabilities. And in fact, a lot of folks think that that hack is even bigger than what the Russians did, and what the Russians did were pretty big. This is still an evolving situation. There's a concern, just like in the SolarWinds case, that there were some leave behinds. What are we learning? What are you learning? What do we know about this attack and its gravity?
As you've already mentioned in the lead-in, this is obviously very much an evolving story. But you know, as the story evolves, it kind of continues to get uglier and uglier. I mean, I think what we're learning is that in this cyber domain, no matter the professed proficiency size of a company, even such as Microsoft, there are still tons of vulnerabilities in those defenses. And so what we're seeing here is that an actor, you know, which is currently being attributed to the Chinese, taking advantage of vulnerabilities, which some reports state may have actually been in existence for almost 10 years. And that's a whole nother road to go down to see about, you know, patching and so on and so forth, but taking advantage of that vulnerability to conduct widespread espionage and you know, exfiltration of data, gaining access as widespread as possible. But I think more importantly, what we're learning is that there is so much activity out there. You know, once you learn about one, such as SolarWinds, just only a couple months ago, how many more actors are out there, you know, actively actually pursuing whatever their cyber activity is trying to achieve, whether, again, it's trying to steal data, gain access, or actually conduct destructive attacks.
And so what is it, right? You made an excellent point, right? We've had so many big breaches over such a long period of time, and it still seems as though we're surprising ourselves and oftentimes spend quite a bit of time justifying it, right? I mean, there are some people who looked at SolarWinds as legitimate, right? Well, we do stuff too. This was not a red flag. So we need sort of global cyber rules of the road. I know the Biden administration is eager to work on that. How do we need to think about the ecosystem so that we're not on the receiving end of surprise all the time?
Actually, I think that brings up an excellent point, and it's a point that, you know, my company here, Red Jack, is working on helping with our customers and partners, is instead of 100% perfect defense, which is inachievable, and I don't care if it's in the cyber world or the physical domain. Instead, I think we're trying to help shift or pivot the focus to resilience. How do you make your networks more resilient to attack? Because attacks are going to occur. Certain attacks will succeed. How do you help mitigate against the successful attacks? How do you harden your networks from defending from the attacks as much as possible? Because research has shown it doesn't take an extremely advanced actor to create an incredible amount of havoc.
Justin, you've been looking and focused quite a lot on, you know, as we were texting earlier today, you know, you said like your head's been so down in Russia that, you know, you haven't been as focused on what we've seen from China. Bring us up to speed on where we are on SolarWinds, what we know about it, to date, as well as how Russia has managed. Brennan, as everybody's focused on SolarWinds, the Russians actually have been remarkably effective at putting pressure on social media companies to throttle their pipes from Russia to constrict support for Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader. So talk to us about what's the latest and on SolarWinds, and what's the latest in how American companies are actually enabling the Russian state to crack down on its opposition.
One of the most interesting, I think, updates in the SolarWinds case in the last week or so is actually not really to do with the investigation itself, but to do with reporting around the espionage campaign, which is that the New York Times published a report a few days ago saying that the White House was planning for some sort of cyber retaliation against the Russians because of what they did through the espionage campaign. And so there was a series of Twitter flurry messages and all kinds of things about this and a subsequent alteration in the headline. But I think what this spoke to, which you sort of were just talking about, is the fact that this was espionage, what happened, and regardless of the fact that it is immensely damaging to our national security, this is the kind of thing that countries would like to do all the time. And it's certainly something I think the US would do elsewhere if given the opportunity. And so all to say, I agree the conversation should be shifted to talking about resilience, talking about defensibility, and not so much talking about concepts like deterrence when we're dealing with espionage. But all to say, I think the fact that the New York Times had that sort of mistaken headline speaks to that usual discussion of how do we retaliate back in cyberspace. But as you referenced, while most of the US attention in the past few weeks has been to this espionage campaign, there's been a crackdown ongoing in Russia on the internet sphere domestically. This started with the protests that were happening when Alexei Navalny was jailed. And the Kremlin was turning to not just domestic, but also foreign tech companies, ordering them to censor content about the protests. And what we saw, which we've seen before, we saw this, for example, with COVID-related information that contradicted the Kremlin line. YouTube, TikTok, there were foreign tech companies that had disturbing degrees of compliance with these censorship directives, taking down content, showing the protests, showing police brutality, calling for more demonstrations. And so there's been several other crackdowns we can talk about, but as a lot of the focus has been on the espionage, we've seen this digital repression hardening even further within Russian borders.
Chris, from your standpoint, I think everybody's been talking about, resilience and flexibility at the end of the day. As the new administration works to try to craft rules of the road, right? I mean, as an intel professional, as a cyber intel professional, what do these rules of the road look like at the end of the day from the standpoint of an operator?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, I think those rules of the road are still being crafted. In fact, I know you mentioned how I was, under the mentorship of Chris Inglis, and with his participation and work on the Cyber Solarium project, I think there was a great deal of effort made to actually create these rules of the road, because a lot of the, shall we say, traditional aspects of, again, kind of going back to that deterrence issue, some apply in this domain and some don't. And that can be for good and for bad. I think that is part of the challenge that our government and industry as well is trying to grapple with is, one, how do you attribute with a certain level of assurance so that you can then publicly go after, if you will, who you think has attacked your assets, with whatever cyber tool is at their disposal. But then just on the flip side of the coin is, how do you craft a response that is robust enough to deter future activity without crossing, hypothetical red line?
Justin, your sense on that, because I know you work with Trey Herr and the team at the Atlantic Council on some of these issues. What's sort of the consensus on what these rules should look like?
Yeah, I agree with what was just said. I mean, I haven't been too deeply plugged into that relative to Trey and the other folks who've been engaged with this. I would note actually months and months before any of this unfolded. And you can check out the Breaking Trust report at the Atlantic Council for a coded database on supply chain attacks and looking at how this occurs. But I think, again, right, the question is, when we're talking about rules of the road, there are some things that apply from traditional deterrence in cyber. There are some things that don't. But also, again, I think we have to differentiate between when we're talking about some kind of military conflict or proxy conflict and espionage on the internet. Because again, espionage is a very different thing. And, you know, I just don't think that any of these commentaries that say Defend Forward failed to block the espionage campaign, for example, is really hitting the right notes.
And actually, if I could just kind of pile in on Justin's comment, because I'm in violent agreement. I think this is another case where words matter. What do I mean by that? Well, in a lot of these reports and a lot of commentary, you hear the term cyber attack. But when you actually look at the actual activity, it could actually be just stealing data, espionage, or is it taking control of somebody's network? Or is it actually trying to finally achieve physical destruction? The specific element of that attack could then generate the response. So you have to be very, very careful in how you, shall we say, advertise what the activity is. So what I mean by that is that in the world of crafting response to activity, going back in the physical world, if you have been attacked by a foreign nation, we're talking potential acts of war, right? Well, right. In this world of cyber, if it's in kind of a technical perspective, a cyber act of cyber espionage, a act of gaining access to another person's network, that could perhaps be considered a cyber attack, and it's very easily called that a lot of times in the media and in open press reporting. But when you're trying to craft that proportionate response and ultimately deter future aggressive activity, you can't treat it as an attack. You have to treat it as, it's because you're also hearing a lot, especially with regards to the solar winds, and you'll probably be hearing it, I think, with the as Hafnium story continues to evolve. You know, it's just a quote, nation states doing what we always do. Well, is that the case? We don't know. I mean, it truly is kind of, I would say, building the plane in flight, but there is some aspects to that.
Justin, just to wrap this up, there obviously Congress and the administration is going to be open to a debate and a discussion about the future of U.S. Social media. How does this behavior, right? I mean, the social media companies on the one hand say, we're all about freedom of speech and free expression. We're going to police it as much as we can, but we want to try to do this as it would light a light touch. There are a handful of people who've been barred. Many people have not, compared with the total number of subscribers. How does this Russia, accommodating Russia and throttling content, whether on YouTube, whether on Twitter, whether on Facebook, at the end of the day, how does that affect and shape the discussion?
I think it highlights at once the complexity of operating in these international markets and also the hypocrisy of a lot of these companies that like to tout these supposed values about promoting free speech above all else and being anti-autocracy and all those kinds of things. On the first point on the complexity, we saw this today where the Russian government announced that the internet regulator was going to be throttling, so slowing down access to Twitter from within Russia because it said that Twitter was not being compliant enough with its various censorship directives, a la what we mentioned with the protests. When they tried to do this, however, this was a completely different matter than simply declaring it over the internet, because all of a sudden there were all of these government websites that became inaccessible. Kremlin.ru and others were not available. There were also a series of private websites that became unavailable. And so I think what we were seeing is a reflection of this phenomena in Russia, which has happened time and time again, where the state says it's going to censor something technically, but it can't actually do it well in practice. And so Twitter actually is probably fine from the business perspective to not comply with these orders, but also continue to be available in Russia because they're going to have to take these blocks down to not screw up, access to these government sites. At the same time, though, the second point, I think this shows the hypocrisy of some of these companies that will comply with authoritarian censorship directives, yet also cry that they promote free speech and also make claims about we're just complying with local laws. And I think, again, there's complexity there, but you get into a very ridiculous whataboutism where we're comparing, you know, hate speech laws in Germany with content orders in China, or law enforcement access by the FSB with, you know, law enforcement requests from the FBI. So as we think about what that means in terms of US regulation, I think we cannot forget that these platforms operate in these oppressive regimes as well.
Chris, any last thought on including on what Justin just said?
Yeah, I mean, again, excellent point made in, you know, at the impact and the interaction of all these different social media platforms in these authoritarian states, try and get that word out three times fast, right? I think also what might be fascinating to that point specifically is what might be different use cases between Russia and China. In fact, I was reading some recent reporting saying just maybe Russia, if you will, kind of the horses out of the barn with their ability to actually cut off dependence from social media platforms, as opposed to what China did, you know, was it 10 or 15 years ago with the Great Firewall. So that's definitely interesting to me, at least. I do want to end with kind of looking ahead, you know, back to these, you know, these two cases du jour of SolarWinds and Hafnium. You know, from a technical perspective, it's a bit cyber hygiene. You know, it's getting back to that resiliency, you know, making it more than just a buzzword, obviously. And it's making sure that our networks can kind of move through these kinds of issues and instances. But then also from a policy side, obviously, and I'm sure like a lot of folks in this sphere, I'll be watching very carefully, you know, how the U.S. government crafts that response. And more importantly, just how much, you know, GOQ public will actually be able to see.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you both back on. Thanks again.
Truly my pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Great to chat. Thanks for having me.
And joining us today is Ron Gula, the president of Gula Tech Adventures and the Gula Tech Foundation that he runs with his wife, Cindy. He is a United States Air Force veteran and part of the Hack the Building team. Ron, always a pleasure having you on the program.
Hey, thanks for reaching out. We're very excited to share some news about the Gula Tech Foundation.
Absolutely great. You and Philip Niedermeyer joined us last year. And I know that you and your wife, Cindy, have been cooking this up for a while to sort of support and inspire the next cyber generation. Talk to us a little bit about the foundation, and then we can get to the awards and the next round you guys will be having.
So the Gula Tech Foundation is something that that Cindy and I, you know, did to formalize some of the cybersecurity nonprofit work we were doing as part of Gula Tech Adventures, right? So we do a lot of investing in cyber companies, but we're also very concerned about making sure this next generation feels very open and invited to this, you know, male-dominated, highly technical, you know, cybersecurity industry. So we created the foundation so that we could recruit a board to help us, you know, select some of the tougher social problems in cybersecurity. And also select winners, help us. So it's not just on myself and Cindy, but so we have the ability to draw from academia, industry, venture, and of course the startup community.
You guys, I thought it was terrific because yesterday on Tuesday afternoon, you guys did your grant award winners. You guys announced those. As well as open up a round for the second round, right, which I think is going to get awarded in May. Talk to us a little bit about the winners. And I have to say, I was not the only person who thought that you really rocked the shawl collar tuxedo jacket in a very subtle way with the T-shirt. So that was well done for awards in the afternoon.
Well, I can only assure your audio listeners that it looked stylish and very, very manly. But yeah, so the first Gula, so what our goal with Gula Tech Foundation is to run some competitive nonprofits, nonprofit donation grants. We found that the same attributes we, you know, try to aspire for cybersecurity startups, you know, commercial companies, we're seeing the same issues on the nonprofit side. You know, what problem do you solve? How do you solve it? What's your vision of success? So we thought that a competition for some significant grant money, you know, we were doing, we gifted, granted $1 million in total, that this would cause not only some competition, but people to really, and organizations really come out to, talk about what it means to go to the next level. And for our first grant, we focused on cybersecurity nonprofits that increased general engagement with African Americans. And that could have been, you know, job development. It could have been working with maybe the poor who happen to be big African American in inner cities. It could be K through 12 education. There's so many different social aspects to just, you know, why aren't there more African Americans in this business, even commensurate with just the percentage of the population is very, very underrepresented. So we're very happy to start off with that. And we are going to be planning future grants throughout this year.
And talk to us about the next round, because you guys want to award another $1 million, right? I mean, there's first, second, third prize, and then a number of folks who are at the $100,000 level. Talk to us a little bit about what you're looking for, what the timelines are, how folks can get involved and apply.
Yeah, so we got a lot of advice from different, very large funds that donate, large amounts of money, and also people who donate, dollars at a time. And we felt that $1 million was, for one of these grants was significant enough to generate, interest in people applying, but also meaningful enough that we could split it between a couple winners. And that might hire a resource, that might pay for a study, it might do a number of things. So for the African American Engagement in Cyber Award, it was $500,000, $300,000, and $200,000. But our next grant is going to focus on a broader topic of cybersecurity, just basically any type of approach or nonprofit that is going to enhance cybersecurity awareness in the general public. And you might go, well, wait a second, we just had SolarWinds, we have the Cyberspace Solarium. Why are we, of course the public knows about this, but the reality is the public does not know about cybersecurity. We have done a poor job as an industry educating them. So we are hoping to award, three top prizes plus four runners up, 250K, 200, 150K, and a couple $100,000 awards, because we think it's such a broad problem. Cindy and I have been approached by organizations who want to create coloring books for, K through 12 that, talk about cryptography and cybersecurity policy and stuff. That's a very specific thing. There's organizations out there who want to educate senior citizens and teach them about how to be safe online and how to, respond to scammers and messages. There are so many different non-technical ways to communicate cyber. It's a really, really big problem. So this grant application is going to open up March 22nd. It's not going to be limited. If you are working in a minority type of thing, you're doing Hispanic speaking, maybe Korean speaking to non-English speaking, elderly. That's the kind of thing we want people to apply. We want to look for innovative ways to educate the public about cybersecurity. And this ties in with Cindy and mine's data care concept. We would want to just increase general availability and knowledge of cybersecurity for the general public.
Let me ask you one last question, right? I mean, when you, Philip Niedermeyer, obviously is one of the people who's passionate about K through 12 cyber education. I know Philip's been working toward that end for a long time. I know that that's one of the things that, interest you as well, right? I mean, you guys are putting your money where your mouth is in order to try to do this. What's the best way, Ron, for us to get there? And what responsibility does the tech industry have, right? I understand from a sales standpoint, right? Apple is, you have security with us. But at the end of the day, there's a lot about that ecosystem that is beyond Apple's control, right? And is not secure, for example, if the site that is running that app is compromised, for example. What is a more holistic view the nation has to take for us to get to that cyber literacy that just people don't have, and their vulnerabilities are pretty astounding?
So right now, the cybersecurity industry is much like the medical field was I'm going to say, you know, at the times of the Wild West, where we're still pioneering things like, you know, sanitation and you know, how we got sick and how the body worked and stuff. If you go to any three or four cybersecurity experts today and you ask, how should my parents be safe online, or how should the local car dealer, you're going to get probably correct information, but it's not going to be consistent. It's not going to be what I would consider professionalized, and in much the same way that the lawyers or the doctors or the aviation industry, you know, has. You know, I had a house recently remodeled. I had some electrical work done, had to be inspected. I had plumbing had to be inspected. Architect had to do it, but I had some IT work done, and there's absolutely no regulations for how to do that type of stuff. And I'm not just saying that regulation's the answer. The point is that our industry hasn't been professionalized, where that entire spectrum of regulation, all the way down to what kids are taught in K through 12, it hasn't been there yet. I mean, we're still sort of stuck where everybody's a brain surgeon, and we have not armed the general public with how to even think about engaging with us or protecting themselves. Until we do that, we cannot have a conversation as a nation about how to train the kids, how to do things like offensive cybersecurity, or who we should be trusting as a society with our data and our privacy. Until we get there, we're gonna have a long way to go, but that's some of the stuff that Cindy and I are working on.
Ron, all the best of luck to you both. You guys are passionate, and you know, are focused on a very, very important problem. You know, I always have to give Philip a shout out on this also. But at the end of the day, you know, the sooner we get to that sort of collective understanding and need for change, the better it's going to be for all of us. Thanks so very much. Thank you for all you guys are doing, and always look forward to having you back on the program to give us an update on whatever's on your mind. Thanks very much, and all the best to Cindy as well.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. If people want to learn about our winners, they can go to gula.tech. That's gula.tech. And we've got the winners of the last award, and we're going to put everything about the foundation there going forward. Thank you very much.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.